The Courtier. Dudu, then, the married dwarf, acted as a defender of tradition and a partisan of the good old times. He spoke in Amun's name when he advised Montcalm to send the new Shavarite slave to work in the fields, for that he came from the enemies of the gods and was no fit person for the house. He stood waving his stumps of arms and sending his deep voice up to reach the ear of Montcalm. But the steward seemed disinclined to remember what Dudu was talking about, or to whom he referred. An Amu boy, bought from the Meneans, named Osarsif. Oh, yes, yes. And after having thus given the other a lesson in the careless and forgetful attitude proper to such a theme, he expressed surprise that the keeper of the wardrobe should give it any thought, much less waste words on it. He did so for the sake of propriety, Dudu replied. It was offensive to the people of the estate to break bread with such a one. The overseer simply denied that they were so fastidious, and mentioned the case of a Babylonian female slave named Ishtarumi, with whom the others in the House of Women got on very well. Amun, said the keeper of the wardrobe, naming the name of the conservative deity, and looking severely, even almost menacingly, up at Montcalm. It was on Amun's account, he said. Amun is great, replied the steward, with an ill-concealed shrug. Anyhow, he added, I may send the new slave to the fields. I may send him, or I may not. But if I do, it will be on my own motion. I like not those who try to throw a noose over my thoughts and lead them on a string. In a word, he sent the spouse of Jesset about his business, partly on the ground that he could not stand the dwarf, but also on a ground that had backgrounds as well. The ground for his disinclination was the dwarf's pompous respectability, which rubbed him the wrong way. But the background was his own honest devotion to his master, Petipray, which sustained a sense of injury at Dudu's pretensions. All this will become clear later on. But ill will against Dudu's sterling personality was not the only reason why Montcalm turned a deaf ear to his words. The steward had a liking for the other dwarf, Beauty, less, perhaps, for himself than because he was an agreeable foil to Dudu. But he had snubbed him likewise when he appealed to his superior in the opposite sense. Good, beautiful, and wise is the desert youth, darling of the gods. That was what Bess had whispered. He, Bess, by name the beautiful, but in fact not such a one, had seen the truth with the unerring penetration of his dwarf senses. The overseer should see to it that Joseph be given tasks, whether in the court or outside it, which would give employment to his qualities. But here, too, the steward had pretended absent-mindedness, and then irritably refused to give any thought to the problem of employment for the chattel which partly by chance and partly by good nature he had acquired. There was no hurry, and he, Montcalm, had other things to think of. That was reasonable enough, for the steward was weighed down with cares, and his kidneys gave him much trouble. The reply was convincing. The dwarf had nothing to say against it. But the truth was that the steward pretended, to himself and others, forgetfulness of Joseph, because he was ashamed of the equivocal thoughts and impressions which he, a practical man, had had at first sight of the slave, when he had been half inclined to take him for a god, the Lord of the White Ape. He had felt ashamed, and that was why he wished to forget and not be persuaded by the importunities of others to act in line with his own impressions. He refused alike to send his purchase to the fields or to think of using him in the house. Refused, in short, either to act or to think of acting in either or in any direction. The good man did not perceive, he tried not to see, that precisely in doing nothing he was acting on his first impressions. And the bottom of his restraint was fear. It arose, just among ourselves, from the feeling which is the bottommost one in the world, and thus lay at the bottom of Montcalm's soul, the feeling of expectancy. Thus it came about that Joseph, garbed and barbered like an Egyptian, spent weeks and months without work, or at most in some light and desultory occupation on Petipray's court, in which he was not very noticeable, for there were plenty of loiterers and bystanders besides himself, and in a way he was pleased and satisfied to have no notice paid him. that is, not prematurely, or until it could come about in proper and dignified fashion. He did not want to begin his career in a false or unreal way, by being drawn into some one of the trades practiced in the courtyard, and being lost forever in that obscure activity. He guarded himself against such a fate, keeping himself from observation at critical moments. He would sit and chat with the gatekeepers on their brick bench, making them laugh with his Asiatic expressions, but he avoided the bakery. Such marvelous triumphs of the baker's art were there achieved as would put his uncommonly good pancakes quite in the shade. Nor did he call attention to himself in the booths where they made sandals or paper or mats of woven palm or pottery or furniture. He was warned by an inward voice that it would be foolish to play the part of ignorant apprentice, foolish and prejudicial to his later career. On the other hand, there was no harm in making lists and doing accounts now and then for the laundry or the granary, and for this his knowledge of writing soon became adequate. At the bottom he would sign with flourishes, "Written by the young foreign slave Osarsif, for his master the great Petipray. May the Hidden One give him long life. Likewise for Montcaw, the steward set above all, greatly skilled in his office, for whom he implores from Amun 10,000 years of life beyond his life. Written on this and this day of the third month of Achet, the time of the flood." In such terms, recreant to the practice of his own land, did he express himself in the consciousness of his blessing and in sure trust that God, seeing his situation and the need of making himself loved, would not take them ill. Such lists and signatures came to the eye of Montcaw. He saw them at odd times and made no sign. His bread Joseph ate with the people of Potiphar in the servants' house, drank beer with them, and passed the time of day. Soon he could chatter with the rest, or even better, his gifts inclining him to use his tongue rather than his hands. He listened to their idiom and took it in his mouth, first to talk, but later to give orders. He learned to say, "As true as the king liveth, by Khnum, the great lord of Shab." He learned to say, "I am in the greatest joy of the earth," and "He is in the rooms beneath the rooms," in other words, on the ground floor. Of an angry overseer, he said, "He raged like the leopard of Upper Egypt." In telling a story, he trained himself to give great prominence to the demonstrative pronoun, this being the custom of the country, to say, "And when we came before this impregnable fortress, this good old man said to this officer, 'Look at this letter.' And when this officer looked at this letter, he spake, 'By Amun, these strangers may pass.'" His hearers enjoyed it hugely. Several feast days fell in each month, not only calendar but also seasonal, as when Pharaoh cut a swath of grain to open the harvest. There was the anniversary of his accession, and that of the unification of the two lands, the day when they set up the column of Osiris with masks and sistrum playing. There were the days of the moon, and the great days of the triad, father, mother, and son. And on all such days there was roast goose and beef in the servants' house, and Joseph's small-sized patron, Bess, brought him all sorts of dainties and sweetmeats from the house of the women, grapes and figs, cakes baked in the shape of cows lying down, and fruits in honey. "Take it, young sandman," he would whisper. "It is better than leeks to your bread, and your little friend brings it to you from the tables of the shut-in ones, after they have feasted. For they grow far too fat with their munching and crunching, and are nothing but cackling stuffed geese before whom I dance. Take it all, then, that the dwarf brings you, and may it do you good. The others have not such food." "And is Montcaw yet mindful of me in the way of my advancement?" Joseph would ask, after thanking the dwarf for his offerings. "Not much as yet," Bess would answer, shaking his head. "He is deaf and asleep where you are concerned, and will not be reminded. But the dwarf is at work to bring your ship into the breeze. Let him see to it. He is thinking how best to make it come about that you shall stand before Petipray, and it shall come to pass." It was Joseph who had urged upon Bess Emheb the necessity of his coming to stand before Petipray, in some way and at some time. But the thing was almost impossible to bring to pass, and the dwarf could only go about it by small stages. Attendance on the master, even of a general kind, and much more the personal service, was firmly held in jealous hands. It was a pity that Joseph had not been granted duties in the stables, feeding, currying, harnessing, and unharnessing Potiphar's Syrians. But never once had he succeeded in leading out the fiery pair. Not even for Netternach the driver, to say nothing of the master himself. That would have been a step in advance, but it was impossible. No, for the present, it would not be his to speak with the master, but only to hear his servants speak about him, to question them of their lord and the way matters stood in the house, and to keep a watchful eye, wherever possible, on the service of the master. The latter enterprise had to do above all with Montcalm, and he had begun putting it into effect on the very day he was bought. And each day the same scene repeated itself. He saw and heard it. Montcalm flattered the master. His lips ran over with praise, and moisture stood in his eyes as he sang paeans to the dignity and riches of his lord. He never failed to laud and marvel at his boldness and virility, his control of his steeds and prowess as hunter, whereat all the world about him trembled. And all this he did, Joseph felt certain, not for his own sake, and not to curry favor, but on the master's account, and thus by no means in a lickspittle spirit. Montcalm seemed a very decent man, not cruel to those below, nor cringing to those above him. His adulation of the master was only to be taken in a good sense, as an expression of his genuine love, his desire to bring by sweet words comfort to the soul of his lord. Such was the impression Joseph got, strengthened by the faint smile, at once gratified and melancholy, which appeared on the lips of Pharaoh's friend as he listened to the words of praise. This tower of a man, who yet in all other ways was so unlike Reuben. And the more Joseph understood the situation in the house, the more clearly he felt that Montcalm's bearing toward his master was only an example of the relations of all the other members of the family. They were all very gracious, very respectful, and delicately considerate of each other, displaying a mutual politeness which was a support, no doubt, but made an impression of exaggeration and strain. So Potiphar to his wife, the lady Mut-Em-Enet, and she to him. The exalted parents in the upper story to Petipre their son, and he to them. They, in turn, to their daughter-in-law Mut, and she to them. Their dignity and self-confidence, supported by outward circumstances of the very best and by their own behavior, seemed, after all, not to be a very firm footing. There was something hollow about it. Therefore, they the more strove to strengthen by all this tact and courtesy each other's self-respect. If in this house of blessing there reigned an atmosphere of uneasiness, which even had its comic side, in this it consisted. If there was a weight of care, herein it lay, and showed itself. It gave itself no name, but Joseph guessed it. The dignity was a sham. Petipre had many titles and honors. Pharaoh had lifted up his head. Many times the highest, at his window, in presence of the royal family and the court, had flung down upon him the goal of favor, while the populace had applauded and made ceremonial leaps of joy. Joseph heard about it in the servants' house. The master was called fan-bearer on the right hand and friend of the king, and lived in well-founded hope of one day becoming unique friend of the king. There were very few of this title. He was captain of Pharaoh's guard, head executioner, and commandant of the royal prisons, or rather he bore the title of these court offices, for they were empty or nearly empty honors. Actually, so Joseph was told, it was another man, an upper officer named Haremheb, or Horemheb, a rough soldier and lieutenant colonel, who commanded the bodyguard and presided over the executions. Very likely he had to render account to his titular head and the honorary commander of the prisons, but only as a matter of form. Certainly it was lucky for this fat, towering Reuben of a man, with his high voice and melancholy smile, that he had not to administer justice by mangling the backs of criminals with 500 blows, or, as the expression went, bringing them to the house of execution and martyrdom to put them in corpse color. It would have been most unfitting and repugnant to him. Yet Joseph was given to understand that much recurrent humiliation and gilded care might grow out of such a state of things. For Potiphar's offices and honors, symbolically represented by the staff he carried in his small right hand, once a bludgeon and now degeneration into a pine cone, were a dignified fiction which not only Montcalm but all his world about him combined to sustain for the sake of his self-respect. Yet secretly, half unconsciously, he knew them for what they were, for unreality and hollow pretense. And just as the pine cone formed the symbol of that pretense, so, Joseph felt, was Potiphar's whole state a symbol of a more far-reaching hollowness that had not to do with offices, but with the man's own natural dignity as a man. Joseph knew, he had memories not personal to himself which instructed him, that social conventions, the traditional conceptions of honor, avail but little against the dark and silent knowledge in the depth of the soul, which will not be deceived by daylight fictions. He thought of his mother. Yes, strange though it was, while he explored and pondered on the situation of his purchaser and master, Petipre, the man of Egypt, his thoughts turned to her, the lovely one, her trouble and bewilderment. He knew about it. It was a chapter of his prehistory and tradition. Besides, Jacob had often told him stories of that time when Rachel, great though her willingness, was unfruitful by decree of God, and Bilhah had had to be brought in and had given birth upon Rachel's knees. Joseph could see that puzzled smile upon the face of her rejected by God, a smile of pride at her maternal dignity, which yet understood that this was a sham and a conception of honor upheld by human standards, but not founded in her own flesh and blood. It was half a joy and half a pretense, countenanced by usage, but at bottom a detestable sham. He called these recollections to his aid as he thought of his master's position and pondered over the conflict between the conscience of the flesh and the expedient honored by usage. Certainly Potiphar had many more and richer compensations than Rachel had had. He was wealthy. His existence was brilliantly adorned with precious stones and waving ostrich plumes. Kneeling slaves attended his ways. His house was full of treasures. His women's house, of the twittering and cackling, lying and sweet-eating appanage of a lordly life, with the lily-armed Mut-em-Enet as his chief and lawful wife. All this redounded to his dignity and availed mightily to uphold it. And yet far within, where Rachel had been aware of her secret shame, he knew that he was not captain of the bodyguard, but only its titular head. Otherwise he would not have needed the flattery of Montcalm. He was a courtier, a chamberlain, and servant of the king, a very highly placed one, overwhelmed with honors and possessions, yet a courtier in the full sense of the word. And the word courtier had a slightly malicious tinge, or rather it was used in two related senses which flowed together. It was a word not used today in its original, or not only in its original meaning, but in a transferred one which kept the original one as well, so that in a quite honorable and respectful way it was malicious, and contained an innuendo which flattered in two directions, with reference both to dignity and to the lack of it. A conversation heard by Joseph, not overheard, but listened to quite openly and in the course of his duties, taught him much about all these matters.